The following program is pre-recorded.
As I know from my own official research and investigation into this, it's not a case of the Ministry of Defence knowing some great secret about UFOs and keeping it from the people. Actually, the Ministry of Defence doesn't know what the UFO phenomenon is. Hence, you're not going to find some single bit of paper in any of this material which goes, this is the answer.
That was Nick Pope, and he, of course, was at the Ministry of Defence at the UK for several years investigating unknowns, basically UFO reports. And as he said in that interview, they don't know, and I've come to that conclusion about many of the people here in this country at the Pentagon and elsewhere. They don't know. They don't know much more than you or I. And I am Jerry Pippin. Hello, everybody. Welcome to our UFO show. ...8,500 pages. That's the amount of information released last week by the UK at the Ministry of Defense. It's the seventh data dump. And as Nick Pope says, if they had an answer, they'd give it. Well, maybe.
Well, if we'd have found an answer, we would have given one. I mean, our brief was to investigate all the sightings reported to the Ministry of Defence. 95% of them we were able to explain in conventional terms, and that's fine. But unknown means unknown. It doesn't mean extraterrestrial. So when you look at the small percentage of UFOs in these files that we couldn't explain, they're very interesting. I mean, there are some fascinating cases, but there's nothing where you can say, well, that's extraterrestrial, and you can take that to the bank.
Probably the most interesting thing in this seventh data dump by the UK on UFOs is that actually in 1967 they seriously considered reports of an ET invasion to be real and authentic. That's right. I said an ET invasion. The UK and the CIA and others were up in arms for a few hours at least, thinking perhaps we were being invaded. Nick Pope had this to say about it on a recent radio show.
Yes, I mean, it should be borne in mind, of course, that this was at the height of the Cold War, so I think people were fairly jumpy. But, I mean, what happened was that six small flying saucers had been discovered in various locations, forming a straight line, and flying saucer fever was, of course, at quite a peak in 1967, and what happened was that very, very quickly the police and various intelligence personnel from MOD actually deployed to investigate all this. Now, not necessarily because they thought it was alien. I think the point is, with the Cold War, they thought it might be something to do with Soviet satellites or something like that. As it turned out, this was a ragweed prank by a bunch of engineering students.
In this latest data dump, there's this share of lost papers, as usual. And we'll get into the Rendlesham thing in a minute. But first of all, this British warship, it lost its logbook after reporting UFOs. And Nick Pope had this to say.
I can see how it would, and I'm very familiar with this case because I briefed Lord Hill Norton on it, who was a former chief of the Defence Staff. The story is basically that it's alleged that crew members on board HMS Manchester witnessed a UFO and tracked it on radar during a NATO Navy exercise that was taking place in 1999. Lord Hill Norton asked defense ministers for any documents relating to this, and he was told that the ship's log for the period in question had been blown overboard by a freak gust of wind. Now Lord Hill Norton,
yeah.
I mean, you know, Lord Hill Norton, of course, stayed on the active list all his life, at five-star admiral of the fleet, you do. So had, I think, 49 years experience in the Navy, served on about 25 or 30 different ships. He said to me this was quite simply impossible, couldn't happen. Never heard of a case like that in all his years. And frankly, he did not believe the Ministry of Defence. Well, even I have to admit, it's quite a stretch. It's quite a stretch that the one logbook that dealt with this, or for all we don't know, of course, but dealt with this period, that one was apparently lost in this freak accident. The ones before and the ones after, that's fine. Which reminds me of another story in these files, which is going to get conspiracy theorists excited and then angry. It relates to Britain's best-known UFO case, the Rendlesham Forest incident, and it's been revealed in these newly released documents that some Defence Intelligence staff files on Rendlesham have been destroyed.
Philip Mantle has a quote on our webpage, UFO Shows to Go, talking about those papers missing. But Nick Pope was definite in this interview he did on the radio in the UK about the fact that these were not missing papers, but papers that had been destroyed.
No, they've been destroyed. Now, policy at the time was, because of the public and media interest in UFOs, it's actually been policy since 1967 that all UFO files should be permanently retained. And yet, the Defence Intelligence staff file on the case, which is really of most interest to journalists and members of the public, have been destroyed. And it's worse than that. It's worse than that because not only have the files been destroyed, but the little destruction slips where somebody has to sign their name and explain why the material have been destroyed. I mean, don't forget, we've already got some quite interesting documents on this case. For example, talking about the radiation levels taken at the site where this thing landed, and the Defence Intelligence staff assessment of that was significantly higher than background. But I know, you know, obviously my talking years after the event about files that I saw is not going to satisfy people, and quite rightly too. I mean, I share people's disappointment and indeed anger that this has happened. It's not a good day for open government or freedom of information.
Nick Pope has been doing his part for disclosure. Recently, he was in Riyadh, that's in Saudi Arabia, on the same speaker platform with Stanton Friedman and Jacques Vallée and a few others talking about UFOs. But it really wasn't a UFO conference. It was about international business. And the keynote speaker for that whole thing, that whole affair, was former President Bill Clinton. So as we watch disclosure creeping ever so slowly toward the mainstream, it may happen any time. What do you think? Okay, we're going to shift gears now and go from the UK to Aztec, New Mexico, where they're getting ready for a big event the last weekend of March. And we're going to be talking to Katie McClure about it. She's the director of the Aztec Symposium, and I think you'll find it very interesting. We have some interesting news about Aztec as well, which we'll cover in addition to the interview with Katie, as we now switch our focus from UFO disclosure to UFO crash retrievals. Don't go away. Investigator and author Anthony Sanchez.
The name of the book is UFO Highway. I found that although I was diverging into multiple areas of UFO research, I kept finding myself back on the same road. And I found that all these different aspects of ufology were interconnected. So I decided to call the book UFO Highway.
This is the book that could not wait for a regular publisher. It had to be released now. The information is so sensitive, so shocking, so well researched. Colonel X comes from the dark shadows for the light of truth. The inside story of Area 51 and the challenging truth about extraterrestrials. The e-book of the century, now on sale. For information and to order, go to UFOHighway.com. We have Katie McClure on the phone, and she's in Aztec, New Mexico, and is chairman of the event, the 14th Annual Aztec Symposium. Yeah, UFO crash happened there in 1948. Katie, welcome to the show, and how are you?
It's a good time of year, and I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Katie, first of all, I'm just amazed that it's been 14 years. Aztec has been one of the longer-running UFO conferences. 14 years. That's amazing.
I know, and especially in a town as small as ours, and what we do it for. Of course, we do this as a fundraiser for the Aztec Library. It's just amazing because people come from all over the world. We've had people from all over the world come just to this symposium.
And you have a speaker coming all the way from the United Kingdom this year. We'll get into that a little later. Let's talk about Norio Hayakawa. He's going to be entertaining this year on Friday night. Tell me about Friday night.
Well, Friday night is traditionally our meet and greet dinner. And what we've done over the years is we make it more interesting. Certainly having Norio Hayakawa come to play some of his original music is going to be fascinating. I mean, Norio, as you well know, is a really good researcher in the field of UFO, Area 51, Dulce especially. But he wants to play his original music that night, which is very lovely. I don't know if you've ever heard it, but it's great.
Yeah, I know. I've done stage shows of Norio before.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, in Roswell last year, we were at the mall for a couple hours doing our thing. Had a big audience, too, by the way. He's a very, very talented fellow.
I know. It's amazing. He can do everything. And that's what he wanted to do this year. You know, Norio's in New Mexico now, so it's real easy for him to pop by and do that. And one of the things I like best about Norio is that he's a deep thinker.
Yes, he is.
Things for face value. He questions.
Oh, very intelligent for a musician. No, I'm a big Norio Hayakawa fan. Now, Friday night, he'll be there for the meet-and-greet dinner. And you have some other things we'll talk about in a moment. But first of all, where's this happening? I mean, where in Aztec is the event going to be?
Friday, March 25th, and it's all going to take place... excuse me... at Aztec High School. They have a wonderful big room with a stage and lighting and good sound and everything. So Aztec High School is located at 500 East Chaco in Aztec. But Aztec is so small, if you drove into town and asked someone where the high school was, they'd probably drive you over there.
Yeah, that's one of the things I like about small towns. They're very friendly. They can always help you find whatever you need. What about Saturday? Same location for the venue?
Yes, all the events will be at the high school, except for the free tours to the crash site. They it really happened. The 1948 crash site here in Aztec, out in Hart Canyon. We'll be giving free tours, and that's going to be led by a lady that we like to call Indiana Judy.
Hi, Indiana Judy. Last year, she did those tours, and lots of people enjoyed them. She's very good at what she does.
Well, she's done a lot of research. Not only, of course, does she follow everything, the research that Scott Ramsey has done in the area, but she also went and talked to the Native Americans in this area who seem to know about that crash site also. And so she tells the people a bit about their story about it from way back in 1948. So it's really well-rounded. And she's, you know, she's very energetic, and she'll walk you out there and tell you everything along the way. So it's great. Comes on Saturday about three times during the day. She'll take guided tours out there.
Now Saturday is the day you have your speaker presentations, right?
Yeah, Saturday is the day with the lectures from our presenters. And the day will end with a open question and answer panel between the audience and all of the researchers up there, and that's always good to get people engaged in the conversation. So the question and answer period is really good, and it's informal here. You know, we're, we expect about, generally about 300 attendees, so it's not so large that you feel lost in the crowd. And I think the presenters we have this year are going to be a really interesting.
Yeah, I want to talk about the speaker lineup here in a minute. Let's go over each of them. But before we do that, let's talk about attending the entire thing on Saturday and Friday night. Can they buy tickets at the door, or do you recommend them buying them online before they show up?
A lot of people do, especially the people from out of town. They'll buy tickets online at AztecUFO.com. And that way they know, especially for the meet and greet dinner night, Jerry, that has a tendency to sell out before the event. We are having it at the high school this year, so we have a bigger room. But generally, if people want to come for the dinner to meet the speakers up close and personal, and also we'll be showing a film by Jose Escamillo.
Yeah.
Called The Greatest Story Never Told.
Yeah, Jose's got a new film out, the L.A. Incident, 1942, the UFO. It's a great show, great film. So is this one you're showing?
He was going to be a presenter, but because he was finishing up that movie, he had to put off this year.
Yeah, The Battle of L.A. is it's getting good reviews. Jose's very talented.
Yeah. So I've seen the film. I think it's great. There was some footage in there that I've never seen before. And I thought I had seen just about everything on UFOs. So that's great. So we offer them dinner, meeting the speakers up close and personal, and also a film at the end, a documentary.
Dinner and a movie and Norio Hayakawa before the dinner starts. I guess that's when he'll start playing.
Yes, before and during. So we open the doors at 5. Dinner will start to be served at about 5:30. It's being catered from a lovely place in town called the Main Street Bistro. And so it's just going to be, you know, it's a very informal evening, but it gives people a taste of what's going to happen on Saturday with all of the speakers, because they give just a brief presentation on Friday night. And some people, if they can't make the all-day symposium on Saturday, they feel they've gotten a pretty good idea Friday night. And if our speakers have any literature or books or things, they have a tendency to just buy those and go home. But most of the people that come Friday night also
we'll get
come
to
Saturday.
The time that everything starts on Saturday morning here in a moment and talk about Saturday in general. But first...
It's an early one, Jerry. It's 9 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
We go from 9 a.m. to approximately 6.
I'd like to, once again, stress that the best way to attend the Aztec Symposium is to go to the website, AztecUFO.com, and basically register there. And you can register right online for the dinner and or the speeches on Saturday. And it's not expensive.
Not at all. We like to keep it, we're still, with the symposium and the attendees and things like that, we're still able to make enough with a small price to give money to the library every year for the extra projects they need. But the admission price for the dinner and the movie and meeting the speakers and talking to them, regular price is only $15, and if you're a senior or a student, it's only $12. Symposium on Saturday, March 26th, the admission price for the 5 speakers is $25, and $18 if you're a senior or a student, and absolutely free if you're a member of the military or any of the first responders in the community.
So, Katie, if you're a first responder or if you're a member of the military, active military, you get in free. I know you did that last year, so I guess it worked out okay.
Right, and we do. And, you know, a lot of people took advantage of it last year, which was great. So we had EMTs, firefighters, policemen, and it's interesting because people from all walks of life are interested in what our speakers are bringing to the table and the research they're bringing.
Okay, about motel space, I guess there's three motels there in Aztec, right?
There's three in town.
Okay.
That people can stay at. And if those fill up, and generally they do, the other two towns that are very close to us, like within 10 miles or less, is Farmington and Bloomfield. So finding a place to stay is not a problem. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's not a problem. The problem is the meet and greet dinner is selling out. So anybody who's coming from out of town, especially, well, a lot of people in town, too, they just buy those tickets right off.
Right. Farmington's very close and lots of rooms there. No problem. So people can make their reservations and come and enjoy the area. It's a great place to hang around, not only for the conference, but stay for a day or two. We'll probably mention that a little bit more later in the program.
It's AztecUFO.com.
That library is something else, Katie.
The selections of UFO and UFO-related books. At the Aztec Public Library.
Well, they can come in Friday earlier and go visit the library. Lots of UFO stuff there. Probably one of the biggest selections ever.
Right.
Anywhere.
The library is open Friday and Saturday. Hopefully they won't run down to the library on Saturday. They'll be listening.
That's just why I mentioned Friday instead of Saturday. I think you had them tied up for Saturday.
It's open from, like, I think 8 or 9 in the morning till 7 at night. On Fridays.
Let's go ahead and do a rundown on the speakers. And first of all, you have one here that I'm not familiar with, Marshall Klarfeld. Is that how he pronounces his name?
Right. Marshall came to the symposium last year, and his daughter. And then I started, you know, we were interested in maybe looking at him further as being a researcher. And he really has done a lot of research, but he's not a mainstream UFO person. This is a guy who has done this research and written this book called Adam the Missing Link, and has been working on it actually for years on his own. And he's from California. He lives in California. His daughter lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And they both came to the, she came, representing her father last year, and she gave us a copy of the book. And so we thought, well, he would be interesting to have as a speaker.
I guess Marshall lays out the evidence pretty well that maybe the human race is a hybrid, or at least started by by the gods. And by that, we mean extraterrestrials. Okay, let's move on to Chuck Wade. He has some important news he's going to release at your conference. I don't know if he's told you that yet or not. But he has... as you know, found a piece of a UFO, and he's had it analyzed, and the results are startling.
He has, and he's been, you know, he's been doing this for a long time, and I think it's just been in the last few months where some really astounding information's coming through. So Chuck came last year, and, you know, as an attendee, and he got up and spoke with the man's just...
yeah, he was on conference there in Gallup, New Mexico, and a film festival. It's held in an antique theater there. Really a collector's dream, and it's been renovated. I don't know if he'll have it again this year or not. Chuck's quite a guy.
The name has just escaped me right now, but we take a survey at the end. And so many people wrote down, we want to hear more from Chuck Wade.
Chuck is really on top of these New Mexico UFO crashes. He chronicles a spate of them happening from 1945 all the way through 1948 there
at Aztec. It does go beyond Roswell here in New Mexico.
If you're interested in UFO crashes, I would really advise listening to Chuck and his presentation. He has an hypothesis on why all these crashes occurred during that time period back in New Mexico, and it deals with the radar we were using at that time. We actually used it as a weapon, according to Chuck. He lays out a good case.
Right, and that's something also that Scott Ramsey touches on when his book should be coming out this year about the Aztec crash. And it had totally to do with the radar.
Yeah, I was visiting with Scott this morning, as a matter of fact. I'm looking forward to that book when it comes out. Interesting, we, in this series of shows about Aztec and your conference, Katie, I'm going to bring in a guy by the name of Mark McClandish. And he definitely got some very strange vibes when he visited the debris field or the crash site there in Aztec, I think in 1993. That'll be before this series is over. I mean, we want people to know about Aztec. I think it's a very important thing in ufology.
You know, it's interesting. One of our presenters is Dr. Robert Farrell.
Yeah, I know Dr. Farrell pretty well. I first had him on the show when he was talking about his Alien Log, the novel.
Yes, and he's written a follow-up to that, too. So it was called The Alien Log and now Alien Log 2. And very briefly, he mentions in there, you know, as fact, as the character says, the crash in Aztec. You know, which is interesting because not too many people, well, they're getting to know more and more about it, but... you know, it's not as mainstream or as well-known, of course, as
And, of course, Aztec happened shortly after Roswell.
Yeah, it was less than
You're right, only about 8 months, I think, if my math is right. You know, you have... Lynn Buchanan is coming back, and last year, he made lots of news, I thought. He assembled 11 remote viewers, and they tried to focus in on Aztec and came up with some startling information. And Lynn's going to be back to report more on this.
That was probably my favorite presentation.
We did a couple of shows on it last year, and both of them had huge audiences from around the world.
Lynn Buchanan is absolutely amazing. And when he actually got up there and explained what remote viewing is and how controlled it is, especially with his company and how he's done it in the past, and, you know, of course, they kind of loosely based Men Who Stare at Goats on, you know, Lynn and some of his work. But just seeing last year how controlled it was, and they gave these 11 remote viewers basically no information other than something as simple as an incident happened. And it was amazing what those 11 people came up with, and a little disturbing.
What he came up with was not only disturbing, but astounding, and we'll get into that in a minute. But first of all, I think we need to note to the audience that Lynn Buchanan is a meticulous guy.
Further into it.
Yeah.
So and this time, and I cannot wait to hear this presentation, he gave them a little more information. So this year, I'm really, really looking forward to hearing Lynn and seeing what these remote viewers. Of course, he's not one of them because he knew too much. So these are really blind remote viewers, in a sense. They have no idea. But last year, and he's got the whole report on that, and I know he turned over a few copies to the library, and when I read it also, even after his presentation, it's amazing. The accuracy, what they come up with, how similar everything is between the different 11 remote viewers was really astounding. So I can't wait to hear his new presentation on, he'll be on Saturday.
Yeah, in his report he described something that could very well be Los Alamos. It's not far from you, where they took the ETs maybe. And the most disturbing thing, as you say, is the idea that one of our men shot one of the ETs with a gun.
Right. That was the disturbing part, and it's like nobody really thinks about that. It, you know, Jerry, it's almost like, you know, when the towers came down in 9/11, you know,
yeah.
They didn't show some of the most horrific things that happened. And the same seems to go with, you know, these crashes. And sometimes, you know, people react badly. And
Katie, you're a master of the understatement.
Disturbing, but at the same time, I don't think it's out of the realm of believability.
You mentioned Scott Ramsey earlier on his latest DVD about that crash at Aztec. He goes into the details about a secret radar location. It's not very far from you. Did you know that? Well, we're going to have more about it.
Good stuff, Jerry. I live so close. I think I mentioned this to you last year. I went to the symposium the first time in 2000. Was it 2000 or 1999? I forget. No, it was 1999. It was the second symposium.
Mm-hmm.
And they had little maps to the crash site. So I dragged my husband and my sister out there, and we're traveling and traveling, and it was a terrible road, and we're traveling. And out in the middle of nowhere, about 5 miles in, I saw a little sign that said land for sale. And I jotted down the number, and then we went out to the crash site, and we looked at it and everything, and I ended up calling that number and ended up buying property out here. So I'm, you know, as the crow flies, very close, but about a mile away from it.
Katie, I can just imagine the ambiance of it all, living that close.
Well, you know, it does. Any person in the area who's never seen anything strange.
You never saw anything, huh? You told me other people were seeing things and experiencing things.
Right, out in Hart Canyon. And recently. We have a thing on our website. It's called the Oral History Project. And we have a couple of people. Well, it's people from this area who have had sightings, experiences, and things like that through the years. And one of them, specifically about Hart Canyon, is out there. But even the fellow that I bought the land from, I kiddingly asked him, hey, have you ever seen any UFOs out here? And he got really quiet. You know, and he was, you know, a very conservative, older gentleman. And he said, well, yeah, I have. You know, it's like everybody's seen something out in Hart Canyon except for me, and I've lived here 11 years.
Katie, through the magic of radio, it sounds like a train's running through Hart Canyon. No, that's here at our studio. I left the patio door open. Nice night. And as usual, a train comes by. I'm not far from the railroad. Let's get back to business here. The Aztec Conference, the symposium, starts on Friday night at 5:30 at the dinner. Norio will be there a little earlier.
Yeah, March 25th and 26th.
He'll be playing, and he's always early, by the way. He's a very prompt guy. Besides being talented.
Well, that's good, because we'll be there all day. And generally, we say the doors open at 5, and people show up at 4 anyway. So
and
that's
so
fine. We'll let them in.
You would suggest going ahead and making a reservation online at AztecUFO.com.
I would, especially for the Friday night.
But if they decide to come at the last minute, and a lot of people listen to these shows right up to the last minute, they can probably get in, at least for the Saturday symposium, if not for the meet and greet dinner.
Definitely for the Saturday symposium, yes.
Let's get back to that Saturday lineup, and let's go down the schedule of the times and everything. You do have a schedule.
I do have a lineup, and I'm going to look at it right now, so ask me another question.
Okay.
I'm looking at the lineup. I know that we're starting off with Chuck. So Chuck will be on Saturday morning at 9 a.m. And all the speakers will be speaking about an hour and 15 minutes, sometimes an hour and a half. After Chuck, right before lunch, will be Lynn Buchanan.
Lynn will be doing the remote viewing report. You know, Katie, your morning session is loaded with very, very good information. Both of those speakers are dynamite.
We have a full audience in the morning. We're
yeah.
not one of those symposiums where there's only 10 people in the morning. Generally, these people come and they stay all day. So, every slot's a good slot for the speakers. So, yeah, we want to start it off with Chuck, with his, you know, the results of the metal that he's collected and the many different crashes in New Mexico, and get that going, because he's a wonderful researcher and he's really backed it up with, you know, a lot of facts and figures. And then we'll go straight to Lynn Buchanan, who's got the further report from the remote viewers of what specifically happened in Aztec with the crash in 1948.
That'll be very interesting.
Then we're going to have a lunch break. And then after that, at 1 o'clock, will be Dr. Robert Farrell, who did write the nonfiction books. But also...
Now, Dr. Robert Farrell has an interesting subject.
Right, and he's, you know, his topic this year will be science behind the alien encounters. The science behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've never heard Robert speak before.
Yeah, I've been around when he's done lectures. We've interviewed him a couple of times, at least.
Oh, you have?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. So then at 2:30, Marshall Klarfeld, which nobody has ever really heard.
Now, I'm not familiar with him at all.
And he's, you
well,
know...
Well, I do know that his hypothesis is, and he says he has evidence for it, that the human race was started about 250 million years ago by extraterrestrials.
And created man in their image.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going by the, and I forget the name of the tablets, that are in the British Museum, from the really, really ancient Mesopotamian, even before that. And these are the things that he has studied, where he says it's pretty darn clear what was written down and what was done with the, you know, pre-Christian, pre just about everything. So he's going to be presenting that with a PowerPoint presentation. So there'll be a lot of things for people to look at, you know, how he read these tablets and things like
then
that.
Then after that, what do you have, a panel or something?
No, then we're going to have Stephen Jones, who's an experiencer.
Oh, yeah, the guy from the UK.
Yeah, this is very interesting. Jerry, every year for the past few years, people in our surveys have really wanted people who have had experiences. And, of course, Travis Walton, I think, was one of the first ones we ever had years ago. And Travis has been here a couple of times. And then we've also had Niara Isley, who is in the Colorado area, who was in the military.
Yeah, she was stationed at Nellis Air Force Base, had some horrible things happen to her. We've had her on before.
Right. And then we had Stan Romanek last year. Interesting, you know, and the audience was pretty much 50-50 on believing his story. But the great thing about that is they get to present it and you get to make up your own mind. Now, I was contacted by Stephen Jones, who we have this year, the fellow from the UK, who has recall of the last 50 years of being abducted or being an experience.
Yeah, I know several people who know him. I haven't had him on the air yet.
Right, and he was, when I first... My first impression was a wrong impression of Stephen, and I wrote him a very nice letter back and said, well, we're not really interested because he immediately called me from the UK, and I don't even know what the time difference is, 8-10 hours, and sent me his book electronically and asked me to read a few chapters, and I realized I had made a wrong assumption because I didn't think it was actual experiences, but it was. So he's going to be very interesting, and he's going to be in the United States right around the time of our symposium. So I've been talking to him for months. And I think, you know, generally we wouldn't be able probably to afford to bring someone in from the UK. But since he's already going to be in the United States, we're able to bring him in.
You know, one of the interesting things about the Aztec Symposium is that you have lots of well-known people who just drop by. I mean, Stanton Friedman, for instance, last year, right?
It was great because actually one of our presenters probably had one of the shortest presentations. I was stunned. And thank goodness Stanton was there. Now, Stanton had also spoken briefly about half an hour Friday night. But he stepped right in, and as in good old Stanton style, because you just have to love, he is so passionate about what he talks about, and he's so intelligent and funny, that he just stepped right in and continued for the rest of the slot that I had slotted for the
I had a special reason for bringing that up, Katie, because over the years I've noticed there's something special, I guess an ambiance or something, about Aztec, the people just kind of gravitate there. I mean, well-known people right there in the audience.
That's true. And we have gotten a lot of our speakers in the past, like Chuck Wade, who have been in the audience for years. And again, Jerry, I want to just stress this. This is, and we have gotten feedback on this too, especially a gal who came down from Canada a couple of years ago. It's very friendly. Very informal, even though the speakers are very professional, and very approachable for any of our attendees to approach any of the speakers. We're not corporate at all. You know, we keep it the kind of that, you know, small town, very friendly atmosphere. And that's what's so great about Aztec and having these presenters here, you know, these worldwide presenters. And they always get a wonderful welcome here because our attendees are very open-minded and also very intelligent. You know, I love the question and answer periods. because then you can see that people are paying attention, they are thinking, they are processing the information, and they have questions. So, you know, to round out the evening on Saturday, we are doing the open question and answers, which is, to me, very interesting because it's spontaneous.
Okay, let's run over the pertinent information again. March 25th and 26th in Aztec, New Mexico.
Right.
The dinner, a movie, and Norio Hayakawa entertaining.
Right.
On Friday night, an all-day symposium, tours of the crash site as well.
That's right.
On Saturday. Now, let's run over those prices again, because a lot of people just don't believe it. They don't believe their ears. This is the bargain. This is the UFO bargain of a lifetime.
Okay. For the Friday night meet and greet dinner, where you have music by Norio Hayakawa, you get to meet the speakers, and we have a film called The Greatest Story Never Told. The price is $15 regular, or $12 if you're a senior or a student. On Saturday, March 26th, the all-day symposium from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. or 6:30 p.m. The price is just $25 regular, or $18 for senior or student. And again, free if you're in the military or any first responder.
And we need to stress that part of the money goes to the Aztec Library, Friends of the Library. It's a benefit every year. You got a great library there in that little town.
Right, and we give money. This is a fundraiser, first and foremost, get on a life of its own. But we help fund the Aztec Public Library with the special things that they need through the year. We have a state-of-the-art digital arts program that they offer to students. I mean, amazing computers and programs, because that's where the future is going, in the digital arts age.
You're right.
And in order to help them bring in qualified teachers and things, the Friends of the Library help with the funding of that and getting those computers and software and things like that. So for a small town of less than 7,000, we have an amazing...
And before we get off of here, Katie, on our website, on the Aztec section, and also on your website, I believe, you can make donations to the Friends of the Library all year round. So regardless of what time you're listening to the show, and we keep it up all year, you can make a donation and help out a good cause. Now, the theme this year is what? They're out there?
The truth is out there.
Yeah.
The truth is out there. And, you know, I also want to tell people, if you're going to come by, Aztec has, you know, we have a great river running through this area called the Animas River. And if you follow it up, you go to the Navajo Dam, which has some of the greatest fishing in the world. But also we have a national monument within walking distance called the Aztec Ruins. And that was the ancient Anasazi Indians who, you know, were in this area long before any of us. And the ruins are just beautiful, and you get to walk through them. And they have a giant kiva there, probably one of the biggest ones in the area, that you can actually walk down into and just feel how it was like when the ancient Native Americans were the only ones in this land. And this is all in Aztec. So a lot of times people will come from out of town for the conference and then stay, especially through Sunday, to visit some of the great stuff around here. You know, the river, the...
Well, they could spend a week there, really.
I know. Well, I think
once again, Katie, the date, March 25th and 26th in Aztec, New Mexico, a great place to go visit and have a little fun and learn about UFOs at the same time. Thanks for being on the show, Katie. And everybody, check out their website, AztecUFOs.com. In that interview, you heard Katie McClure talk about Scott Ramsey. And he probably did the most research of anybody on the Aztec crash. And Scott told me Saturday morning in an email, we were discussing something else. He mentioned his book would be coming out soon. He also has a interesting DVD for sale about it, a new one, or fairly new. And I believe that's Roswell, I'm sorry, I believe that's Aztec1948.com. Might check that out. Let's go ahead and play an interview we did with Scott and his wife, Suzanne, several years back. about the entire Aztec affair. I think you'll find it interesting. It was recorded at Eureka Springs, Arkansas, at their Ozark Festival, UFO Festival. By the way, that is coming up again in April. Ten months after Roswell, there was another UFO crash in New Mexico. It happened near Aztec, located not far from Farmington, up in northern New Mexico. There were reports of dead ET bodies, wreckage from a craft hauled away by the U.S. Army during the dead of night, reports of extreme security. What really happened in March 1948 in what we now refer to as the Aztec crash? Our guests are the premier experts on the subject, Scott and Suzanne Ramsey. Welcome to the show, both.
Thank you for having us, Jerry.
Pleasure to be here.
It's always good to see you.
I'm here to support Scott. Scott's much more the expert. He's put in the miles on it, believe me.
Scott, first of all, I want to thank you for coming by to do the show with me. I mean, you've had some interesting experiences with radio interviewers. You married one, right?
That's correct, Jerry. Yep, she had me as a guest on her show and talking about the Aztec crash. And, well, that was the start of our relationship.
Suzanne, why don't you tell us a little bit about that radio show? What was it like? What did you do?
Oh, we covered all different types of topics. I really like to give people the opportunity to think for themselves, and I think if they're given a variety of information, we're smart enough that we can make some good decisions.
So Scott took you away from New Mexico and a radio career. Where do you live now?
North Carolina. My goodness. The elevation, we went from, let's see, I was at over a mile high, about 6,500 feet high, to about 1,200 or about 200 feet high, and, you know, humidity and everything else totally different.
We'll get to the subject of Aztec in a moment, but this is a people program, you know. We're interested in people, and here Scott comes to your radio station. He sits down in front of the microphone. You interview him. I guess it was love at first sight?
Not even close.
Yeah, I think I fell in love right off the bat.
That was the right answer, honey.
I was just curious, Jerry, how do you talk a beautiful young lady from moving from Farmington, New Mexico, that's well entrenched in Farmington with her own show and her own business, and how do you entice her to move almost 2,000 miles to North Carolina?
Well, Scott, you knew the answer, I guess. How do you?
I'll give him some good advice.
Scott, I think she's kidding you. I think she saw something in you right off the bat. Come on, Suzanne. Tell us the real scoop, huh?
Well, I'm going to be honest. As much as I enjoy roses, I think the thing, and this is going to sound kind of hammy, but bear with me, we are newlyweds, that for me, in interviewing him, I saw his integrity and his dedication, and it didn't matter so much the topic as it did to me the fact that he was just honest and really was looking for answers. And I had such respect for that, and it was so refreshing, I guess, that that was really the thing that pushed my buttons. So.
Okay, Scott. Suzanne said you're honest and sincere. I hear lots of things about Aztec that are not necessarily complimentary.
Well, Aztec has a lot of black eyes, and I knew that going into it. I heard about the story on a business trip out there and came back to North Carolina and started to research a little bit. And the more I dug into it, it was very controversial. Frank Scully, of course, writing the first book on it, Behind the Flying Saucers, in 1950. 2 years later, the story basically cratered. It was devastated by another writer, J.P. Kahn, who did an article that Aztec was just a big hoax and that Frank Scully had been duped.
I think that Aztec had lost some of its momentum for many years, and one of the things that Scott, through his research, has unveiled and kind of gone down and rebrought it to a head. Farmington, though, I might add, had its own experience. And this was how many years later, honey?
2 years later.
2 years after the Aztec incident, there was what they call the Armada. And Scott would probably be able to give you in detail what happened. So they had a huge experience with UFOs. Tell them about the Armada.
Well, Jerry, about 2 years after Aztec, in March of 1950, the entire town of Farmington, experienced what they called the Armada flyover, and it was hundreds of UFOs flew over the town of Farmington. It made front page, of course, in Farmington, and was seen throughout northern and northeastern New Mexico, witnessed by townspeople, firemen, state highway patrolmen, business leaders of the community, and it was quite an
Scott
episode.
Scott and Suzanne, it seems to me that New Mexico has been the center of UFO crash activity. I mean, especially back in those days.
Well, I can't speak on the other crashes. I'm very focused on just Aztec. New Mexico was then and still is now a hotbed of UFO activity, and I don't have the answer to it. I have a lot of speculation. Was it because of all the military activity, the development of radar, the detonation of the first atomic weapons, the storage of atomic weapons, the manufacturing of atomic weapons, highly advanced radar being prototyped out in that area? I don't know. I don't know if any of that has a connection, but, you know, as we put it all on the table and look at it, they sure had their own involvement of a lot of activity.
This flyover by the UFO is probably over 100 of them at least, according to newspapers. That's very interesting.
Well, the Armada happened, it was St. Patrick's Day of 1950, I believe it was.
Wow, 3 years after Roswell and a couple of years before the Washington, D.C.
I have only reports from what I've read for the old archive newspapers that it was simply a flyover.
But they did have, wasn't there a red? Isn't there one that seemed to be different?
Yeah, there seemed to be a lead UFO that was a very brilliant, almost molten red in color that was quite larger. And then, depending on the reports you read from that time, it could be up to hundreds of UFOs behind it.
Back to the Aztec crash itself, there seems to be some question about exactly where near Aztec this crash occurred.
Well, it's funny. Suzanne and I were just going over some maps the other day. We stopped at a map store and looked at some USGS maps. And to answer your question, the crash site today is about 11.5 to 12.5 miles outside of Aztec to the northeast. And first time it's ever dawned on me in 8.5 years, it's really not in Aztec. It's either Mount Nebo or Turley, New Mexico, according to the USGS maps. It's sort of like a Roswell case. The alleged crashes in Roswell never happened in Roswell. They happened in Corona and the plains of San Augustine, Aztec being the major town that's closest to the alleged site.
Well, Suzanne, Farmington's not that far from Aztec.
They're about 10 miles apart. And nowadays, it's almost a solid
businesses
and homes in between.
Are there any eyewitnesses? Have you found any eyewitnesses to Aztec?
Allegedly, any of the witnesses that we've put in the credible category that Suzanne and I have talked to over the years never saw the actual recovery of how it was taken out. Two of the people we've interviewed claim to have seen two bodies through the portholes of the craft. If you look at other reports of other people over the years...
I understand this Aztec crash, they had a lot of ETs on board.
Well, up to 16 occupants, yeah. That story, 14 to 16 seems to remain consistent. Unfortunately, I try to base my talks that I give based on eyewitnesses we talk to, and they had been run off as soon as the military arrived. They were talked to and chased away, so we have never talked to a witness that was there as the recovery took place.
You know, you got to pat the military on the back. They seem to be able to keep these witnesses quiet. They just don't talk.
Well, Ken Farley talked to us back in the late 90s or 2000. He was dying at the time. We interviewed him in Phoenix, or actually right outside of Phoenix, Arizona. We interviewed him. Randy Barnes and I flew down to Phoenix, and he was on oxygen and knew he didn't have much time left. And he told us the military was very abrupt. A lot of people early in the years talk about the Air Force recovery. I don't think it was Air Force. but they were threatened with their lives, that it was...
Well, that's a good witness. How did you come across him?
Yeah, and he wanted to talk for years, and we kept getting hints that Ken wanted to talk. And when we were finally contacted by a friend of his that Ken was ready to talk, we didn't waste any time. We grabbed airline tickets and rental car reservations, and we got to Phoenix in a pretty big hurry. Ken Farley's story was he was in Durango visiting an aunt en route down to a little town called Cedar Hill.
That must be close to the crash.
Right. Durango's just, I don't know, 20, 30 miles north of the crash site. Highway 44 in the old days ran from basically Albuquerque up through the Four Corners area and then went straight north into Durango. Today that highway is referred to as Highway 550. Of course, Ken hadn't been back to the area in a long time, so he's referring to it in our interview as Highway 44. And his story was he was coming down from Durango to meet a friend of his who was going to be dropped off in Cedar Hill, just north of Aztec, and the two were going to continue to San Diego. And upon his arrival in Cedar Hill to meet his friend, and Cedar Hill, depending on where you are, it's an elevation higher than Aztec, his friend claimed a lot of activity going out what we call, you know, Heart Canyon Road. And the two, being young in their late teens, early 20s, decided to see what all the commotion was about and got out to the crash site. Now, they're not residents, so they don't know anybody. They don't know the police officers. They don't know the oil field workers. They don't know the ranchers. But they got out there, and Ken claims to have seen this disc approximately 100 feet in diameter, extremely large disc, laying on the mesa.
He also did go closer to it, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Ken and his friend, you know, trying to condense this into a 20-minute interview, but they climbed up on the craft.
Climbed up on the craft?
Oh, absolutely. The craft, according to everybody, and this is one story that remains consistent, is the craft was virtually intact. If there was any damage, it was on the underneath that they couldn't see.
In other words, the ETs were still inside the craft, not outside.
No, not with the witnesses we've talked to. They claimed through the portholes you could see two bodies slumped over, control panel, for the lack of a better word, and they were not your stereotypical large-eyed almond entities. They were, as Ken says, you know, and you know, this is 50 years later, small in appearance, 3, 3.5, 4 feet, but oriental in appearance from the one face he could see. Well, actually, it's hard to tell whether they're grays or what, because the bodies, and again, this story remains consistent over the years, they looked as though they had been burnt. They were a brownish or burnt color.
So, Scott, you're saying it was a violent crash, whether caused by the radar we were using at the time or
something
else? I've
looked into that theory. I spent a lot of time on the radar bases. I have not drawn any conclusions on that. Jerry, I've just tried to do the whole research based on documentation and eyewitness interviews. There's been a lot of other things that have come out about that. Radar, obviously, it could be one. Could they have just crashed due to a problem? That's another. Were they shot down?
No thunderstorm connected with this crash, right?
No, there was a bad brush fire that drew the oil field workers out there that early morning. It's the only reason that the oil field workers got called out to the site. Doug Nolan, one of the El Paso oil field workers, arrived at his boss's house, Bill Ferguson, and Bill Ferguson told Doug that we're going to Blanco or somewhere. We're going out to Heart Canyon. There's a brush fire near the drip tanks, and El Paso had some large drip tanks at the base of the mesa. It had nothing to do with the crash, according to everybody we've interviewed. Probably a lightning strike that night. They said the fire had no way involved any fear for where the drip tanks were.
Scott and Suzanne Ramsey are our guests. We're talking about the Aztec crash. We'll be back with this exciting story. But first, let's pause for this word. Why visit the Grand Canyon in Arizona? Marv Mason knows why.
Mainly because the Grand Canyon is known as one of the seven natural wonders of the world.
No one gives a more personalized tour or knows more about the Grand Canyon than Marvelous Moth.
My main thing is education on the geology, because the Grand Canyon is a life record. It shows us where we were at one time on the planet with the continental drift and all the layers that were laid down by sediments, and then how the canyon was carved. And, of course, the views, you know, a picture doesn't do it justice. But it's nice to have somebody there tell you about it that's lived there.
It's the best way to tour the Grand Canyon. Mar picks you up in a modern van at your hotel in the Grand Canyon area and takes you on a day-long tour. Contact Marvelous Mar Vacation Tours. Call and talk to him personally. 928-707-0291. Or visit his website.
MarvelousMarv.com. Real easy, real easy.
Welcome back to our show on Aztec. Scott and Suzanne Ramsey are our guests. And we're talking about the Aztec crash that happened in 1948. When we went to the break, we were talking about the crash in detail and some of your witnesses. Did anyone describe what the vehicle looked like, the UFO?
Interviewing Ken Farley when we did, he said obviously it was seamless. It looked like a brushed or polished pewter. Again, he didn't know Doug Nolan. We didn't interview Doug Nolan until about a year and a half ago. And Doug told the same story. They even described it was so perfect it looked like it had been molded.
Do we have a time for this UFO crash? Night or morning? Or?
No, we've never been able to put a thumbnail on that. It was no more than hours, because we know almost for sure that the craft was tracked by a Cuba police officer outside the town of Cuba. Cuba, New Mexico, if you take your finger and follow it out of Aztec, southeast, going back toward Albuquerque, I would say it's 80, 90 miles away from that town. It's between Albuquerque and the Four Corners area. It's about the largest community you'll go through.
So you have a police officer as a witness?
Unfortunately, he passed away before we got to him, but talking to his friends, he allegedly tracked it that night. There had been a lot of sightings in the Four Corners area and Cuba prior to the night of the 25th, or morning hours of the 25th, and he allegedly tracked it by vehicle, losing it several times and picking it up again north of Aztec, where he followed it out Park Canyon Road.
Sounds to me like this is a good witness, don't you think?
Jerry, that's tough. I don't know. I've racked my brain on that a lot. Manuel never really went into great detail to his friends prior to his death. I missed interviewing him by a number of years. All reports say it seemed to be in some kind of distress, fluttering back and forth, flying low and very slow. Obviously, back then, for him to track it and losing it several times, but... it's hard to piece that part of the story together.
I mean, it seems to me that this is authoritative, at least. A police officer. Wasn't there a second police officer?
The authorities. That story remains pretty consistent, too. Late morning, early afternoon, when the second police officer showed up at the scene, he informed everybody to clear out and get out, because the military had already been notified that this craft was laying on the mesa. Got other reports through the years, secondhand reports, saying the military showed up in the air, and not on foot, but believe it or not, through helicopters, which had been recently introduced into the military.
Of course, that's fairly new.
Matter of fact, Doug Nolan said... in our interview, he didn't know what amazed him more, seeing a disc laying on the mesa or the helicopters. And that really fits into the timeline. And, again, it's consistent. It's incredibly hard after...
Yeah, a long time, 60 years.
...try to put a smoking gun to it.
Well, I think one thing that might be important to know, too, is that... And do you want to describe to them about it opening up?
Yeah, that,
and how they got open?
Yeah, I've heard through the years of how they entered the craft, and it wasn't until we got a hold of Doug Nolan prior to his death. he talked about they were able to, I guess Bill Ferguson, his boss, showed up with a some kind of rod, poker rod, fire rod, something they used in the oil fields back then. And the craft, about the only damage that Doug recalled was a broken porthole, which you keep hearing year after year. I mean, the old story going back. Yeah, the porthole already had some form of damage. Ferguson got a poker rod or some kind of rod, and they were able to poke through the porthole. And I said to Doug, what would make you do that? You know, and Doug said, you know, 19-year-old kid, we not knowing what it was. Yeah, I know I would. I know I would. It doesn't sound normal, but it would probably be. And their thing was, is anybody injured or is there any survivors? And by poking around, Doug said they were able to access the craft, a trap door.
Kind of like in the movies, you know, you poke around and the door opens.
Yes, that's exactly right. Now, the two fellows that Scott has interviewed did not go inside. I think that their braveness ended there.
Other oil field workers allegedly, according to the witnesses.
So there were a group of people around.
We count 19, and 19 people that we've been able to, ranchers, two police officers, brave themselves to take a peek inside, and I think that's where the stories have filtered down, that there was, you know, 14 and then two upstairs, so as many as 16. Yeah, we just had an incident where a rancher that was very concerned with the story of Aztec because he claimed he owned the land out there back in 48. And, yeah, he's getting up in years, and Suzanne and I just pulled the real estate records, and I don't doubt his concern, but I think at his age, the difference of 48 to 49 to 50 to 53 is a blur to him because we pulled the deeds on the land, and he certainly does own land and did own land out there, but he didn't purchase it till 1953. Right. He, you know, everybody has a little bit of time dementia. I know I do with all our traveling. So
that's exactly it. But one of the things that I think is so time-consuming and why it's taken Scott so much time through this research is to document and to know, is what they're saying accurate, and do we have something to back it up? And that's where it's excruciating in time.
We have all the documents up in our room, all the deed transfers going back from 36 to 53, which, you know, tell the story of who owned the land and when it was transacted and when it was deeded.
Scott, I wonder how long it took the recovery operation by the Army. I think you agree with me, it's the Army.
Well, the story goes, according to our witnesses, that it took whatever transpired in there as far as a recovery took about 2 weeks.
Well, it was big enough to hold 18, 16, 15 ETs, a crew of 15. That's a pretty big ship.
No, Jerry, that's one of the problems I have. You know, it was a 100-foot diameter disc, you know, depending on the reports, up to 18 feet tall. I think Bill Steinman's research back in the late 80s was the most accurate on size. And that's one of the problems I have. How do you take something that size and move it? There was reports that they were able to take it apart, that it came apart in pieces, and yeah, I've never talked to a witness that could substantiate that because my witnesses were all gone by the time that part would come in. But, you know, that for the critics, that's certainly, or the skeptics, that's certainly one bullet in their cylinder is how do you get it out of here?
I haven't been out there. Is it desert or mountains? Or?
Yeah, a little bit of both. Hart Canyon Road is an unimproved road to this day. The craft sits up on top of a mesa, which is commonly referred to as the Arkansas Loop or the Arkansas Bend, and that's where Hart Canyon Road takes a left-hand turn, circles up, and heads towards the Colorado border.
I was just going to say, and the elevation is about 6,500 feet there, so that gives you kind of an idea.
Well, I've certainly tried over the years to find something, a bomber or an experimental aircraft that crashed. Something obviously impacted the top of the mesa. There's so much military activity going on, but, yeah, we've looked at crash reports or incidents, as the military likes to call them. We've looked at civilian incidents, and you know, certainly with all that air activity out there north of Farmington, you had a bomber crash. East of Bloomfield, there was, you know, a fighter crash. But there's nothing in that exact area that we've been able to uncover. After the helicopter showed up, we have one person who we never got to interview, claimed that as the helicopters came down to circle the area, that there were fighter aircraft. And back then it would probably be a P-80, the old Pursuit 80, or later became the F-80 aircraft. He claimed to other people that there were fighter planes in the area. But, yeah, we had two deathbed confessions. We had another gentleman came forward that said he worked on the cleanup after the craft was removed. He didn't even know it was a UFO crash or a UFO landing. To him, it was a cleanup that they had to perform. And unfortunately, Jerry, you know, with the age group of everybody, it seems like we get to a witness and a few years later they're deceased, or in some cases a few months later they're deceased.
I know they made a documentary on that, and you were in it.
A little bit. I was interviewed for the documentary, and I traveled with the crew for a number of days. And subsequently they came to our home in Mooresville, North Carolina, and did some interviews with Suzanne and myself. And they did a really nice job putting it together. They've got Stanton Friedman, Nick Redfern, Rich Dolan, Carl Flock to show the opposing side of the Aztec story.
What does Stanton think about Aztec?
Well, I think when I first talked to Stanton, he was a little standoffish and a little skeptical, which it was smart because, again, Aztec's got a black eye. But I think Stanton's seen enough now that he's opened his eyes. I'm not going to put words in his mouth, but he's given me a lot of encouragement. He's been a dear friend to Suzanne and I, and tried to keep me on the straight and narrow on where I look and how I qualify and quantify some documents and witnesses. Our jobs jointly are not to convince people it happened or not. It's to go out and gather as much facts as we can historically to put in front of people and say, was this a hoax or was it a cover-up?
You know, one of the unique things about the Aztec story is that the public library there in Aztec is involved in this. It's a fundraiser for them to get a new building, right,
well,
Suzanne?
They have an ingenious young lady who is Leanne Hathcock, and she is the head librarian, the director of the library there. And a few years back, she knew they desperately needed a new library. And it's very small, lots of services and programs that they offer, but unfortunately, they just have outgrown it and by heaps and bounds. And she felt like there was going to be a need for the future of a new library, and she needed to do some fundraising, and she wondered, what was it that made Aztec unique? What did it have to offer that no place else does? And she went into the history and found out about the Aztec crash. And she felt like, wouldn't that be interesting to bring people to this area, do a symposium, and draw them to, you know, get involved and be interested in, you know, this topic.
Scott and Suzanne, I take it you guys have no doubt that Aztec happened.
Jerry, I've looked at that. If somebody's pulled the wool over my eyes over the years, and of course we have some interesting declassified documents. Obviously, it's no smoking gun to Aztec. But if anybody's pulled the wool over our eyes, we've had a bunch of retired people that haven't seen each other in 10, 20, 40, 50 years whose stories still to this day stick together, and I think that would be a pretty tough task.
Suzanne, you're from there, or at least you lived there for a while. Had any UFO experiences yourself?
I lived there, I'm going to guess just right off the top of my head, about 12 years. And I have never had an experience myself, and I had heard bits and pieces about Aztec, but I have heard from public officials, people that are involved in politics, to all walks of life, people that have had experiences out there, and people that I really consider credible people.
Governor Richardson seems to be pretty active.
No, he really seems very proactive in getting information out.
Actually, the Air Force has been very cooperative because everything I write, which isn't published yet, but I'm very pro-Air Force and very patriotic. I fully understand why, if something like that happened in 1948, they would have covered it up.
good way to end the show, Scott and Suzanne.
One of many,
thanks,
I'm sure.
For a great show and a lot of information on Aztec.
Thank
sure.
you, Jay. We appreciate
a pleasure.
This has been a look at Aztec with Suzanne and Scott Ramsey. An Aztec conference is coming up at the end of the month, at March 25th and 26th, out in Aztec, New Mexico. And it's a very interesting conference, as you heard earlier in the show. If you missed any of it, or if you'd like to find out more information, we have banners on all our websites, jerrypippin.com, ufoshowstogo.com, as well as ipodshows.net. Just go to any of those websites and you'll see the banner. Click it on and it'll go over to a page that we have about the whole affair. And this is the 14th annual one, and the price is very reasonable. We're talking $25 for an entire day of speakers, and we're talking about first-class speakers, and $15 really if you want to go to the meet-and-greet dinner on Friday night. It's all held at the high school there in Aztec, New Mexico, and it's sponsored by the Friends of the Library. So we urge you to consider going there. Last year, Stanton Friedman just dropped in and ended up speaking. And as a matter of fact, you never know who's going to show up in the audience there at Aztec. But speaking about Stanton, we have an interview I want to play here that we recorded sometime back at Sunset Station in Las Vegas. And it was at the Crash Retrieval Conference there. And Stanton had some interesting things to say. So let's play that interview. And don't forget about Aztec. Just if nothing else, go over to AztecUFOs.com. That's their website. And click on the information. You can register right there online. It's something you might want to see. In fact, I know you'll want to see it if you're interested like I am in UFO crash retrievals. And speaking of that, let's pick up that interview with Stanton Friedman. By the way, Stanton, we have a presentation of him on our website at UFO Shows to Go. That he did in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, on the same stage as President Bill Clinton at one time. So disclosure is getting closer and closer. I mean, they weren't there at the same time when they made their presentations, but they were there at the same week, the last week of January of this year. And so, as I said earlier, disclosure is creeping ever more closer and closer. Let's talk to Stanton now. Let's play this interview from Sunset Station in Las Vegas. Stanton, I heard some great things about your trip to Table Rock on Thursday.
That was fun. I enjoyed myself.
And you, of course, will be speaking here at this conference as well. And this conference really is probably pretty dear to your heart simply because of the subject matter.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've been working on crash flying saucers, or working about them. I haven't been on any crash flying saucers for more than 25 years. And, you know, it's kind of funny. I'm giving the same, the same title for the talk, and Table Rock, New Attacks on Roswell and MJ-12, and I'm doing that here. But I had 2 hours to speak there, and I only have 45 minutes here. So I'm going to be talking very, very rapidly.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can cover some of the things that you're not going to be able to cover here, too. I know that we have talked about this in the past, and your book is just incredible. And before we go any further, let's talk about your latest project. So you got a new book out or anything?
I don't have a new book out. I've got one outline. I've got a couple chapters done, Flying Saucers and Science. And I'll try to. I've done about 75 papers on UFOs over the years, a lot of MUFON conference papers and little articles and stuff. And the idea is to update the papers because I cover a lot of subjects that nobody else really covers. Travel to the stars from somebody who's worked on fission and fusion rockets and stuff like that.
I like that already.
Well, I'm pointing out the errors in the way of those astronomers who think that they can say it's impossible. when we have a past history of their saying that's impossible about things that we now know are possible. For example, a great astronomer in 1903, October, just over 100 years ago, published an article in which he considered the future of flight. The only way man would ever fly, he said, would be with the help of a balloon, 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight. And when he found out about that, he said, well, maybe a pilot, but certainly they'll never carry any passengers. 20 years later, another great astronomer, Dr. Bickerton, proved that it would be impossible to give anything sufficient energy to get it into orbit around the Earth. He said, look, here's our finest explosive. Here's the amount of energy it takes per pound of stuff that you want to put in orbit when it's moving 18,000 miles an hour. Here's the amount of energy per pound of explosive. It's short by a factor of 10. He made two bad mistakes. One, there better, more dense energy content of rocket propellants, the right ones, than an explosive, which are rather messy, obviously, if you want to build a rocket with them. And secondly, you don't want to put the rocket fuel in orbit. You want to put the payload in orbit. What he showed was it would take 10 pounds of propellant to put 1 pound of payload in orbit. My favorite, though, because I live in Canada and I'm a dual citizen, I complain about both governments pretty equally. Dr. Campbell in 1941 was tired of all this science fiction crap about taking a man to the moon. He was going to show that was nonsense. Published a long scientific paper trying to figure out what would be the required initial launch weight of a chemical rocket able to get a man to the moon and back. Now, that's a legitimate question. How big does the darn thing have to be? And pages of equations. Bottom line, it would have to weigh 1,000,000 tons. Now, fast forward 30 years, less than 30 years, and we get three guys to the moon and back. Initial launch weight of the rocket was all of 3,000 tons. He was off by a factor of 300 million. So when astronomers do calculations about space travel, they are almost invariably astronomically in error. Why? Not that they're stupid, it's because it's something about which they are ignorant. They don't know about aeronautics, astronautics, that kind of thing. Incidentally, some of the silly assumptions he made were that you'd use a single-stage rocket. And of course, we don't use single-stage rockets. He assumed a limit of 1G acceleration, and our astronauts have to take several Gs. As a matter of fact, I was just over at the display of the Liberty 7 spacecraft, which was recovered from the bottom of the ocean. That was one Gus Grissom was in. They got him out, but the spacecraft went down, you know. And there's information at that same facility, Science Center up in Kansas City, that one of the astronauts in testing work had taken 16 Gs, and another one had taken 20 Gs. And Dr. Campbell assumed a limit of 1G. He also assumed something that a lot of people don't think about, that the rocket has to provide all the energy for the trip. But we use cosmic freeloading. I don't know if anybody's heard of cosmic freeloading, but
Let's talk about that for a minute. I like the term.
Well, when we launch, there's several things you note. One, we launch from near the equator, Cape Canaveral. We try to get about as far south as you can get. And we launch to the east. Why? Because the Earth rotates at about 1,000 miles an hour at the equator. That's a freebie. Second freebie is we launch it so that if the moon didn't come along, it would come right back. Fortunately, the moon's rather regular in its path around the Earth. Why not let its gravitational field pull you in? Why should you provide the energy? Third, when we come back, Dr. Campbell assumed you had to fire a retro rocket. But every pound of propellant you use at the end had to be launched from the Earth at the beginning, slowed down at the moon, takes propellant to do it each step of the way, launch from the moon, and slowed down back here. What do? We say, thank you, God, for giving us an atmosphere, gives us something to breathe, and we can slow down the rocket by being smart instead of powerful. Apollo 13, the story, you know? You come in at the correct angle. If you miss that, either dig a hole in the ground or you miss the planet. So you put all these things together and you say that the people who say you can't get here from there don't know what they're talking about. It's like saying, how can you have a powerful computer on your desk? Look at these vacuum tubes. Look how much energy they produce. Sorry, we're not using vacuum tubes anymore.
I think I get your point about the whole thing, Stanton. You have a wonderful knack of breaking it down so we can all understand it.
I hope so. I mean, my feeling is I'm trying to reach the world. I'm not trying to preach to the converted, and I'm not trying to impress people with esoteric phraseology. And I used some examples in my lecture the other day of the fancy phraseology that the noisy negativists use, and it's funny. Because instead of investigating, they're proclaiming. You got to deal with the world as it is. And I put out, there's four basic rules for debunkers, those who practice debunkery. It's not my term, but I like it. One is, what the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. Two, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. Three, if you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's a lot easier. Those people are all kooks and quacks, and you know. And four, do your research by proclamation. Investigation is too darn much trouble. And I get people saying, well, how come there aren't any sightings by professional people? And I say, why do you say that? How much effort have you made to find them? All the surveys show that 5 to 10% of professional people have seen a UFO. That doesn't mean they're broadcasting it, which is another story, of course. Hard to get them to go on your show to talk about what they have seen. So I feel that there is no point in my being an apologist ufologist. Tell it like it is, and you'll get people's respect. And the big thing is you encourage people to open their minds and to open their mouths, too. I check all my audiences at the end of my lecture. Typically 10% have seen one, but only 1% have reported what they have seen. Biggest reason, they're fearful of ridicule. I want to let them know it's okay. You don't need to worry about ridicule. If you stick to the facts, talk to the right people like me. I'm not going to laugh at anybody. And that's a big thing. But I personally believe if any major newspaper, doesn't have to be the Washington Post or New York Times, made a sincere effort to elicit reports of former military people that took place while they were in the military and said they'd protect witness identity and all this kind of thing, give them anonymity, whatever. And here's a number to call, a toll-free number, and here's an email address and whatever. I think they'd be swamped with reports. And I like military cases because guys on duty very rarely lie about their official activities. I'm not talking about drugs. I'm not talking about sex. I'm talking about what they're doing when they're monitoring a radar set or something.
I understand.
There's a difference.
And you got a point there.
Well, yeah, you talk to military people, and you got everything to lose. If the boss catch you lying about being on guard duty or that kind of stuff, you know, you're in trouble. And I find so many good reports. Because what I do is not only ask how many of you have seen one and then how many of you reported it. Is anybody left? I'll ask how many of you were in the military at the time. If there's still anybody, I'll say you want to tell us about it. Then I get some great stories. For example, a guy says, they took my pictures. I'm waiting for the rest of the story, and he's sitting there in the audience.
I'm waiting for that one, too.
Yeah, and so I say, look, you don't need to stand up. I'm not asking your name, but I'm sure everybody would like to hear about it. Everybody claps. So, reluctantly, while I was flying a four-engine aircraft for the Air Force out over the Pacific, there was another plane 20 miles ahead of us. It radioed back that there was a saucer heading our way. We had gun cameras. We took pictures. We radioed the base we were going to. This is all standard operating procedure. When we landed, the film was taken. Pilots don't take film to the drugstore. It goes through the proper authorities. And we were debriefed and told never to say anything. I had another guy who told me, he said, I'll tell you privately. He was piloting a helicopter in Vietnam. Flying saucer zips around the helicopter, scares the bejeebers out of them because they thought it was a new Russian vehicle. It was back in the 60s, and they're going to be obliterated any moment now. You know, it's a very sleek kind of thing, comparison to a helicopter, almost anything is, I guess. And it went off, left them alone. So naturally, he reported it. You're supposed to report any new technology in battle because everybody would like to know that there's a new weapon system there. And so the next day, the commander of the unit comes over and says, Lieutenant Jones, you didn't see anything strange yesterday, did you? Yes, sir, I reported it. You didn't hear me, Lieutenant Jones. You didn't see anything strange yesterday. Well, do you like flying, Lieutenant Jones? Yes, sir. You didn't see anything strange yesterday, did you? No, sir. Well, you get enough variations on this theme and a picture begins to come out. So that's why I say appeal to the military people. And I'm still looking, well, I had two stories today here about possible witnesses about Roswell.
Still, even now, all this time later.
Even now, all this time later. Well, to illustrate why I'm an optimist about finding more, last week it was announced that the oldest surviving World War I veteran in Nova Scotia had died. He was 106 years old. World War I now. And there are still 10 left in the country of Canada out of 30 million people. So if we still have World War I veterans, which ended in 1918 after all, then probably there are still a lot of people around who know about 1947. You know, that's not too big a stretch. People are living longer these days. And I'm hoping that some of them will take the attitude that one of the important witnesses about Roswell was then Colonel, later retired Brigadier General Thomas Jefferson Dubose. He was chief of staff to General Roger Ramey, who was head of the 8th Air Force in Fort Worth, Texas, and the 509th at Roswell, the military group there, reported to General Ramey. Now, he told me that he took the call from General Ramey's boss telling him three things, three orders. He said, I want you to get the press off our back today. This is July 8th, 1947. I don't care how you do it, but get them off our back. Two, I want you to send some of the wreckage that's due to be there shortly here with one of your colonel couriers today. General McMullen was in Washington. Dubose was in Fort Worth, Texas.
So you said a colonel as a courier.
Yeah, yeah. He wasn't playing games about this. And the third order was, I don't want you ever to talk about it again, not even with your buddy Roger Ramey. That's an order, Colonel. Do I need to put it in writing? No, sir. When a two-star general tells a colonel what to do, he does it. People sometimes look at me when I say that. I said, you know, this is right after World War II. You didn't question commands. You followed orders. That's the way things were. What was nice is that when I talked to, I had to track him down and find him and win his confidence, and not long before he died, which was like age 88, he told me that, look, Stan, I like what you're doing. If I remember anything else, I'll tell you about it. After all, what can they do to me now? Which was an interesting thought. You know, he's already 88.
And the point there, of course, the unspoken point, is that these guys risk not only getting in trouble, but they're losing the retirement and everything else.
Yeah, veterans benefits, all that sort of thing. And there is an inherent patriotism that you don't see so much of today that goes with the World War II veterans. There was a world war that everybody agreed on. The Germans and Japanese were doing terrible things and so forth. Today, you know, after Vietnam, there were a lot of protests. There weren't many protests about World War II, not while it was going on. So I'm hopeful that we can get more witnesses to come forward. It takes a concentrated effort. And as a matter of fact, while here, I spoke with a local reporter who's been a writer for 15 years, not just newspapers, but does magazine articles. And after he started off quite negative, I gave him a hard time. And I think won him over that, yes, there is a story here about the government cover-up. Because I have maintained a number of times publicly that if any major press group would spend 10% of the effort that the Washington Post, say, put into the political Watergate, going after the cosmic Watergate, that it would take less than 6 months, starting with somebody like me. And I told him, there's a Pulitzer here. And it's easy to prove there's a cover-up, quoting government information. Not me, not I think, I believe, whatever. Here's what the facts show. Show the blacked out document, the white out documents that always get a laugh at my lectures, you know. I can't show them on radio because you can't see them over the microphone, but, and I'm kind of hopeful that I can get him sufficiently interested because I know that the solid story is there. The real problem, and it certainly doesn't apply to you, but is many of the people in the media take great pride in their knowledge of what's important in the world. The New York Times, the Washington Post, we're on top of it, you know. And everybody agrees. I've never heard anybody disagree with the notion that if flying saucers are real, that's a big story. Everybody agrees. The biggest story of the millennium. Maybe two. However, these people who take such great pride in their knowledge figure that if this were true, they would know about it because they keep up with what's important in the world, and they don't, so it must not be true. And anybody who says it is must be some kind of a nut, and we're not going to waste our resources looking for something that can't possibly be there, because if it was, we would already know about it.
You've got the media pretty well nailed there, Stanton Friedman. I think really, I've been in the media for 40 years now. I hate to tell my age, but they... You know, this ridiculing this is a thing because, hey, if it were real, we'd know by now. I mean, they're informed, but they're naive at the same time.
You know, isn't it interesting that the Iran-Contra scandal was broken by a Lebanese newspaper and not by the Washington Post, which is right in the backyard of where things were going on. So it's hard to move the media, and I've often said if they spent 10% of what they spent on such important stories as Monica Lewinsky and Elian Gonzalez and Gary Condit, remember him? They could blow the lid off. And the kicker here is that there's a step beyond that. What happens when the truth does come out? That depends, of course, what truth comes out. If it's like War of the Worlds, aliens are destroying Earth, you know, killing 50 people every day, that's very different from saying the planet's being visited, but they haven't destroyed anybody yet. You know, I mean, War of the Worlds, in other words, created panic, but you can understand the panic. I was in New Jersey in 1938. I mean, it was only four. I didn't hear the broadcast. But if you believed the broadcast, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, then you had a reason to panic. What could we do against Martians who were destroying New Jersey and killing people? You know. But if it's played straight, one of the things that would happen, and I think this is one of the key reasons for not revealing the truth, it's one thing to fear panic, and that depends on how you handle the story, but I think it would mean that an awful lot of people would push for an earthling orientation, as opposed to the nationalistic ones that we all have, Americans, Chinese, Greeks, Peruvians. If we start to think of ourselves as earthlings, then governments lose power. No government wants its citizens to owe their allegiance to the planet instead of that individual government. Nationalism's the only game in town, as far as I can see. So that's part of the story. Another part of the story is not only power on the part of government, but where do we go from here on this planet? I try to look at this planet as an alien would. I am not an alien. I mean, I live in Canada, but I'm not an alien. I'm a dual citizen. I think from their viewpoint, we're a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare. I look around the world, and, you know, I used to take great pride in, gee, when my kids grow up, it's going to be a heck of a lot better world than when I grew up. World War II.
Well, yeah, we all thought that, and it seems to me it's going the other direction.
Frankly, yes, I think it is. I don't think it is a better world. And one of the things that bothers me, and there are a lot, but I do a lot of checking on people who claim certain credentials. I call colleges. Did this person attend there? They can tell you that, if you got a degree or whatever. They can't give you a grade point average, but you can find that out. And I almost invariably find that the person I'm asking about, and that's the reason I'm calling because I was suspicious in the first place, didn't attend there. And then I ask the person I'm talking to, typically the registrar's office, do you get a lot of calls about people claiming to have gone here who didn't go here?
Let me guess. The answer is no.
The answer is all the time we get
calls. Oh, I missed that. I missed completely.
Okay. Yeah, and the one of the saddest stories I heard, I called the Air Force Academy. It's a prestigious place, after all. And the person I was checking on had indeed not graduated from there, as I suspected. And she said, and then I asked her, you get calls about people claim to have gone there. She says, you know, we are prestigious. We get a lot of calls. People claim that they went here. She said, the saddest story, and this is people who hadn't gone there, about people who hadn't gone there. She said, the saddest story is a woman calls and says her fiancé had attended there and had lost his diploma. And she thought it would be great if she could surprise him with a new diploma. Is that possible? Oh, yes, surely. You know, give me the information and we'll see. Turned out the guy had never attended there, and I'd sure like to know what the rest of that story was.
Yeah, I'd like to have been there when she was told, right?
Well, what I'm getting at here is I'm concerned about a lack of ethics, of morality. People won't seem to think there's anything wrong with lying about their credentials, lying about their background. That scares me. Will people do anything for greed? You know, Enron makes sense in that kind of a situation. So that is of concern to me.
I would think as a researcher that actually would be a concern, too. I mean, do you have, I guess you've developed over the years some way to tell if a guy is really pulling your leg or not.
Well, I always try to check, though. And, well, last Monday, literally this past Monday, I was at the Eisenhower Library in Abilene, Kansas. And, of course, I've been championing the original Majestic 12 document.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I want to talk to you about that in a minute. Maybe you'll answer me right now.
Well, the biggest objection, there's a whole book by Kevin D. Randall called Case MJ-12. Came out this year, January, in which he claims basically that there's nothing to the documents. They're all frauds. Now, one of his, he does his research by armchair theorizing, and in one particular way, one of the documents, the Eisenhower briefing document, says, Briefing Officer Admiral Roscoe H. Hillencoder, MJ-1. He said, that proves the documents are fraud because he was a vice admiral, not a full admiral, and he would never have called himself admiral. And the names of the members of the MJ-12 group, there are generic ranks for everybody. What I mean by generic ranks, you use the term general, whether it's brigadier, major, lieutenant, general. You use the term admiral, whether it's vice, rear, or full admiral. Standard practice, as it turns out. In many situations, you have a mix of civilians and, you know, because what rank does a civilian have compared to the military? Well, I was over there and dug out several examples of memos that had been written by President Eisenhower's staff secretary. By this time, he started off as a colonel. By this time, he was a Brigadier General Andrew Goodpaster. And he would sit on these top-secret meetings, and he'd write a memo of the conference, memcons, they called them over there. I found a number of instances where he would list the attendees using generic ranks again, and maybe five military people, only one of whom was a four-star, including listing himself, General Goodpaster. The memo is signed, A.J. Goodpaster, Brigadier General. So here we have an exact duplicate that is somebody calling himself by generic rank when he himself was a lower rank.
Yeah, good example.
Yeah, and so that proves that that is not a sufficient reason to throw out the documents. And there are a whole bunch of these kinds of things that people make claims about that when you go checking on them, it turn out not to be true. But they do their claiming sitting in their armchair instead of going to the archives. I've been to 20 archives. It takes work. You got to plow through it. And the Abilene, Kansas is not exactly in the middle of the world. You got to drive 3 hours to get there, you know, from Kansas City. But I get a little tired of people. I'll be talking about that tomorrow in my article about the tax on MJ-12. There was another one, Popular Mechanics. Did a cover story on Roswell. I love the way magazines do cover stories with Roswell in big, bold letters, you know, got to sell magazines, of course. They make noises about the people in Roswell just taking advantage of gullible people. The museum in Roswell, which has had 1.35 million visitors, is free. No admission charge there. The magazines aren't free, you know. Anyway, they had this June, this year, cover story, Roswell. A guy says, well, sorry, folks, but the bad news is Roswell didn't happen. What are the reasons? Well, it's now been shown that Frank Kaufman was a fraud, and he's been involved in this right from the start. What? I started the research in the mid-70s. No Frank. The first book came out in 1980, The Roswell Incident, no Frank Kaufman. Bill Moore and I did five more papers by 1985, no Frank Kaufman. I started the Unsolved Mysteries program in 1989, no Frank Kaufman. He came out of the woodwork from Kevin Randall again in 1991, and he says he's been involved from the start, and several of us have noted that there was no reason to believe anything Frank said for a variety of reasons. The second reason they said, oh, gee, too bad, they got the morning reports. Now, these are things that keep track of Colonel so-and-so was assigned here, the major has joined the outfit, just personnel transfers kind of thing. They were not classified. Why in the world would you find anything in there about the recovery of a crash flying saucer and alien bodies? It would certainly be top secret. You're not going to put it casually. Oh, yeah, found a saucer and three bodies.
And Colonel so-and-so went to launch.
Yeah, that kind of thing. The third thing is, they said they had all, the military had, all this stuff was declassified. There were 11 boxes of stuff at the National Archives. And the trouble is, what the boxes had was the junk that the Air Force had put together for their big fat report. But there were no declassified documents about Roswell.
So none at all.
No. I wish I'd find them. I'd love it. There was another article in Skeptic magazine with the big word Roswell on the cover, trying to sell magazines, and they show a picture of a beautifully artistic saucer stuck in the ground, sleek, metallic, round, flock of sheep down below, and military vehicles in the background. And the only crash they talk about is the one on the Brazel Ranch north of Roswell. All that was found there was debris, darn it. It's not an intact saucer. It's not half of an intact. Little pieces of stuff spread out over an area three-quarters of a mile long. You'd never know that from looking at that picture. The picture's totally irrelevant. He also tries to put the date of the first book at 1988, he says, when in fact it was 1980. And he buys the Air Force notion of saying that the story first came out in the National Enquirer when Jesse Marcel, Major Marcel, the intelligence officer at the base, came forward and claimed that he had recovered wreckage of a flying saucer in 1947. Well, the story was in 1980, and the date is significant. I gave the Enquirer reporter, a man named Bob Pratt, a very good reporter, whom I had met and who served as a liaison. The Enquirer had a five-man panel, four PhDs and a master's degree, to decide the best case for the previous year, and Bob was liaison with the panel. I had given him Jesse Marcel's name and address because Bill Moore and I had finished our work on the book. We first book came out that year, and we'd already talked to 62 people. So rather than tabloidizing the story, how else would the Enquirer get the story if Major Marcel didn't go to them? And they also have a line about me. Also in 1978, Stanton Friedman, a UFO researcher, can't say nuclear physicist, you understand, met with Marcel and started looking for other witnesses. Well, this garbage gets repeated, and so I get a little irked at stuff like this that's put out with government labeling on it, the Air Force report. It's 1,000 pages long. We paid for printing that monstrosity, and it's got lies in it. And then the New York Times picks up on it. They did a 60-column-inch story. It was a pretty good-sized story for the New York Times. Front page, upper left-hand corner, Sunday Times in 1994. There's no better placement for a story in a newspaper in the United States because the newspapers are stacked, and that's what you see when you look at it. Not one comment from people involved in the story. They talk about Mogul balloons. And if he'd done any checking, he would see that nothing about it matched the story of what the witnesses says the wreckage looked like. And that's the New York Times.
You know, Stanton talking again.
The original document was the Eisenhower briefing document. Attached to that was a Truman Forrestal memo authorizing Operation Majestic 12. And then we found the Cutler Twining memo. Cutler was Ike's national security advisor. General Twining was a big wheel, and he wasn't quite yet chief of staff, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, but he was head of the Air Force at this time. Okay, subsequent to that, there was another roll of film with the report for instructions on how do you handle crashed saucers and bodies, Special Operating Manual 1.01. And then after that, there was this whole bunch of documents received by a guy named Tim Cooper in Big Bear Lake, California. Well, I'm satisfied that the Truman Forrestal memo, the Eisenhower briefing document, the Cutler Twining memo are genuine. The SOM 101 Special Operating Manual, I'd say it was 80-20 likely that it is genuine. And then my work on the other documents says they're all phony. And some of them are what I call emulations. And I found the originals in books. Somebody retyped them, changed a few words, used an old typewriter, of course, scanned the handwritten information, three different pieces of data, for example, I approve July 9th, 1947, Harry Truman. Three different handwritten things on the document. You can put the emulation right on top of the real, and those fit precisely. And they all have mistakes in them. And so once I got on to how these were done, I was able to find originals for seven, clear-cut, published in books, no question about it. And then as I looked at the others, I could see what they were doing. All kinds of phony documents. Now you say, well, why would anybody do that? It's a lot of trouble. Well, it isn't if you do it the way I said. You retype, you scan, or Xerox, doesn't matter. And then you make it look old and dirty. You crinkle it and, you know, looks good window dressing there. Well, the standard thing in the intelligence community, if good material gets out, you flood the market with garbage, including enough mistakes so that any smart person could show that it was garbage, and then you have that rub off on the genuine stuff. Well, this is garbage, so that must be garbage. Guilt by association. So it's unfortunate. It would be nice if these were all true, genuine, real, honest documents. But once I've had people look at, here's the original, here's the emulation, they recognize that the language is almost identical word for word, and there are incongruities. For example, there's a directive to General Wiedemeyer, he was a China expert, to go to China in July 1947. Now, the emulation is a directive to General Twining to go to New Mexico to look at a saucer. And the Wiedemeyer one, it says, when you're finished in China, go to Korea, which makes sense, close to Japan right after the wars, 1947. In the emulation, it says, when you're finished in New Mexico, go to Sandia. Sandia's in New Mexico. Sorry, fellas, that's a goof.
Right, right, that's out of Albuquerque.
Yeah, and there are, all of them have this kind of incongruities, if you will.
Well, let me ask you about the thing that's really come up in a lot of shows recently. It's about this story about President Eisenhower, instead of going to the dentist, goes out to Edwards Air Force Base and meets an alien.
Well, yeah, Bill Moore did a lot of checking on that story. The background is that he was staying out in Palm Springs, California, at some wealthy guy's house. And the press hadn't seen him for several hours. Now, the press is there to keep tabs on the president. And suddenly they were worried that, maybe he had a heart attack. You know, what's going on here? Something serious may be happening. So they raised a fuss with his press secretary, Haggerty. Where's the president? Well, let me check. He's busy with something. The story that comes out then, oh, well, he was having dental work done. And, you know, kind of uncomfortable, and he doesn't want to talk to you guys right now. And everybody can understand that, especially back then. Now, Bill Moore did a lot of checking on that story many years later. He found the widow of the dentist. The dentist was named. She couldn't remember her husband ever working on the president. You'd think she would. I mean, it's not...
I agree with you.
Secondly, he found the list of thank you notes from the White House. Everybody loves to get a note from signed by the president. You know, they make these up by the gross. Thanks for your help during our visit and stuff like that. There was no thank you note to the dentist. Third, they keep pretty good medical records on presidents. You know, when they go to the doctors and when they get shots and everything. Little polyp removed, whatever. There's no mention of the medical records of dental work that day. Now, does that prove that Ike met with an alien? No, it does not. It means he could have met with an alien. And I should point out, in 1952, Ike was president-elect. The election was November 4th, 1952, and he became president January 20th, 1953. In that interim, he'd made a secret trip to Korea. Everybody thought he was staying at the Waldorf Astoria. They had people who came down and talked to the press, and they just talked with the president. He was working on this or that. He had been whisked away early in the morning, put on a plane, and made a secret flight to Korea. So
if we were court lawyers in a trial, we could say, hey, he's done this before.
Yeah, yeah. There's precedent, in other words. Yeah, right. And there's a whole book, Ike Spies, which makes quite clear that Ike was very much into intelligence work, into quiet work. He tried not to put stuff on paper. He personally approved every U-2 flight over the Soviet Union. He didn't delegate that to somebody else. He didn't design the airplane, I don't mean that. And then he took full responsibility. First, you know, they said that Gary Powers' U-2 had gone off course. Sorry, bad winds blowing in the wrong direction. The one that was shot down over the Soviet Union. And then finally when Khrushchev said, hey, gotcha, we got the pilot, we got the craft, we got the camera, Ike stood up and said, because of the secrecy in the Soviet Union, we have to know what's going on because we are concerned about our national security. And I give him a lot of credit for, you know, coming forward. But what I'm saying is I can't prove that didn't happen. It is possible that it did happen. And I use that as an example when people say, well, how come they've never met with our officials? You know, the usual, why don't they land on the White House lawn kind of stuff. I say, how do you know they didn't? I do have a good story along those lines, though. Two different people have told me they saw official Air Force footage of a craft landing at Holloman Air Force Base.
In New Mexico.
Yeah, in April 1964. Aliens getting out, military people walking over, greeting them, and they all go off together. Two different people have said they've seen the official footage of that. And I said, well, you know, how do you know it wasn't a Disney kind of... Stan, we've seen that kind of footage. We've seen official footage. If I can get a third guy to tell me that, then I'll believe that that film exists, you know. So that would have been a contact, even if it wasn't with the president.
You've got to let us know when you find that third person.
Yeah, I would certainly do that. And, you know, once in a while you do get lucky, like when I was at the archives the other day. It didn't take me too long to get what I was looking for, partly because they're cooperative archivists over there. But you got to keep looking, and you have to have high visibility, programs like yours, so that people know who to contact. And within the last day, partly because I was on a big radio show last night, I have had several phone calls about people who have information for me that I'm dying to talk to find out what's new. And, you know, we want to get the data before the people die. My toll-free number, 877-457-0232. That's 877-457-0232. I have a live answering service when I'm not in. I answer my own phone, but I can't do that when I'm not home, and I don't have a cell phone. We'd like to hear from anybody who's got something to relate that could be of significance and where they're not so worried about, you know, what happened a lot of years ago. Maybe it's time to talk.
And, of course, we have it over on our website as well, our telephone number, Stanton's toll-free number, so you can call and then give him a tip.
I'd look forward to it. The more the merrier.
Thank you very much, Stanton. I know you have some other things to do. It's been incredible. We could spend hours.
My pleasure indeed.
Tales of High Strangeness. Jerry Pippin's Parazone. Check out our stories of the horrific, the interesting, the spiritual on the paranormal pages of JerryPippin.com.